Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, December 24th, 2024. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. It is our famous best of the year. It is not, Emma.
Christmas Eve Eve. It's now Christmas Eve.
No, it's not Newsday Tuesday.
Oh. I didn't know which one we were going with.
Well, it's okay.
I'm sorry I'm so slow today.
Well, that's okay, because we are actually time traveling now. We're recording this at a time that is not Christmas Eve, but in fact, many eves before then.
You can understand why I might be disoriented because of all the time travel.
For those people who don't time travel on a regular basis, it can be very disorienting. Today on the program, we have Rashid Khalidi, professor of modern Arab studies at Columbia University, author of The 100 Years War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, 1917 to 2017. This is an interview we did in March 2024, March 4th, to be exact, one day before, my sister's birthday. I get confused between my sister and my son. March 5th, March 7th. One of the people I know's birthday. And I always had that problem with Myla. I couldn't tell her birthday for a long time because I get confused.
You were saying earlier that you thought Christmas was on December 23rd. So maybe your brain just doesn't register certain things, like the Liz Cheney of it all.
Yeah, I think there are some things that I just absolutely have a block on.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, it's the day before. And yesterday's interview with Naomi Klein was the day before my birthday, which I do remember my own birthday.
Right. That's good.
It's helpful.
Yeah.
I think so. Anyways, but this is Rashid Khalidi, really important book. Joe Biden even pretended to read it.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. If people recall, Joe Biden was photographed around Thanksgiving in Nantucket walking out of a bookstore with this book in hand. And the reason people found it so offensive is that this book is probably the number one book that you should recommend to people if they want to get educated about Palestine. And the fact that Biden was doing that after Kamala lost the election and he helped commit genocide in Gaza, it was a spit in the face of a lot of people, but that's just because of how widely respected this book is.
Yeah.
And Khalidi himself.
Like, oh, maybe I should read into this a little bit. But
a little too late, I guess.
A little too late. I will say something else about this book. I don't know if it was in preparation specifically for the interview, but I was reading it, probably reading it around this time, actually, last year, because my daughter was home on vacation, and I had it on my nightstand, and, when she comes home, we don't exactly share a room, but we sort of do. I mean, because it's like a three-quarter wall.
It's a divide.
And I get a text from her with a picture of the book, and she says, "Can I read this?" And I almost start crying. Aww. I was like, "Oh my God, I've been waiting my whole life for you to ask me if there's something that you can read."
That's amazing.
But aside from that, also a very important book in and of itself.
Yep.
This is a good interview, and he's a fascinating guy. We've had other interviews with Ilan Poppy, who I would also recommend if you want to go deep into this, and Peter Beinart too. We could have done Peter Beinart's interview Oh, but we did it last year. Okay, yeah. So it was I guess we bent the rules a little bit. He was like but he was around October. So
I mean, it was important that we had an interview related to the genocide in Gaza, which is ongoing, and so here's another one.
So listen to this interview, and then Matt will put in a couple of YouTube clips, and then tomorrow, my understanding is that many of you will be celebrating Christmas.
Ah.
Checking
out. Most people will be celebrating and you'll be on the front lines.
I, of course, will be out there picketing. I haven't quite figured out where I'm going to be picketing.
Suggest the Fox News studios, and perhaps there's a tree could light on fire?
Speaking, I know we're in the future, but speaking of the past, but then going forward, we got to pull the annual War on Christmas clip. There's been virtually no war on Christmas this year, and that's the problem. Everybody's defenses are down.
Perhaps that's the special Matt clip for today.
Oh, possibly. But I think we want to just do a new version of it.
Okay.
Because I don't think we did it last year.
Oh, that's true.
Be that as it may, there will be clips after this interview, I think. With Matt, you never know.
It's the Matt surprise.
It's like potluck.
Yeah.
But, folks... enjoy your Christmas, or as they say, Merry Christmas, and have a fun Christmas.
And Happy Hanukkah, reminder.
Oh, yeah, tomorrow is Hanukkah.
Yes.
Yeah, we're not going to have a show tomorrow, but we will be back on Thursday with another best of. So enjoy it, and we'll see you on Thursday. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Rashid Khalidi, professor of modern Arab studies at Columbia University, author of The 100 Years War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, 1917 to 2017. Professor, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. And we have all read your book. We were telling you beforehand the various we've been giving it to friends and children,
family, and trying to get people to be educated. And if anyone in our audience is interested in this topic, you pick up and haven't read 100 Years War on Palestine, everyone should pick that up ASAP.
So I do want to talk to you about where we are today, but want to sort of go over the history of this war waged on Palestine, on Palestinians, and so we have some context in which to view what's happening today.
Right.
You start in 1917. Zionism is been around at that point for almost 20 some odd years. And it is not necessarily focused on a so-called return to Israel for Jews at that point, although it certainly comes up. Why 1917? And just give us a sense of, like, you know, how these moments, and there's six of them that you point to, sort of create a new phase of this war.
Right. The reason I deliberately chose 1917, because what I wanted to do was to get us away from this essentially false narrative of two peoples struggling with one another. I mean, there are two peoples. The point is, it never was just between Palestinians and Israelis, or between the Palestinian National Movement and the Zionist movement. It was and is a war in which the big battalions actually were not coming from either the Palestinians or the Zionists. They were coming from the British Empire, and they've come from the United States. This is not a war in which Israel has, or before that, you know, the Zionists in Palestine were fighting all by their lonesome. They were not able to do anything that they did in the first 20 years after the Balfour Declaration without the British Empire, without the British Army, without what Zev Jabotinsky called an iron wall, provided in this case by the British. So I'm trying to show that this is a war which has always involved external actors, the most powerful external actors on the globe at every phase. I mean, the British Empire before World War II was the greatest empire in history up to that point. And the United States is the great power of the post-World War II era. And it has always been on Israel's side. I mean, we see this during the war on Gaza, but we've seen it in every previous war going back to 67, and including going back to 1948 for that matter. So I was trying through the framing starting it with 1917 to show this is when the conflict takes on the characteristics that it's had ever since. Yes, there was Zionism before that. The first Zionist Congress was 1897. Yes, there were the beginnings of Palestinian nationalism before this. But the conflict takes on the configuration that it has had ever since with the Balfour Declaration, with the entry of the British into Palestine, and has always had that characteristic since. You know, we're not seeing a war of the Israeli army alone on Gaza. Every shell fired by Israeli Merkava tanks is a 120 millimeter artillery shell that the United States is providing. Every 155 millimeter artillery shell is provided by the United States. Every Hellfire missile, every warplane in the Israeli arsenal is an American warplane. Every helicopter, Apache helicopter, is an American helicopter. The United States is providing these things, in my view, in violation of U.S. law. They have to be used for defensive purposes. They can't be used in ways that contravene international humanitarian law or human rights. And so this blank check is, in effect, makes this an American-Israeli war. This is Biden's war, not just Netanyahu's war. And it was Britain's war on the Palestinians when they crushed the great revolt of 1936-39. They brought 100,000 troops into Palestine. There were only a few hundred thousand Palestinians at the time. There was one soldier for like every eight people. That's not a war of the poor little Jewish community in Palestine on the Palestinians. That's a war of the greatest empire up to that day against the Palestinians. And that's why I frame it in that way, starting in 1917.
Can you walk us through that? Because I think like the, you know, one of the things that over the years I have come to understand, you know, having had a Jewish education that was very sort of like Holocaust, Israel centric, maybe even beyond, like even from a cultural or Hebrew or religious education, was a sense that there was nobody there, right. And that this was empty territory. But the existence of a revolt and a rebellion, and the British bringing in a military personnel to quiet that suggests, well, that's not the case, obviously.
Right.
Will you walk us through that era?
Sure.
Because this is an era, too, where we're just starting to see an increase in Jewish immigration there. When you're in the tens and even in the 20s, the percentage of Jews in Palestine is still single to double digits, early double digits, maybe in the teens at one
right.
point.
Right. Until 1932, I don't think the Jewish population as a proportion of the whole went above 20%. It was 17-18%. It balloons because of the rise to power of the Nazis in 1933. By 1939, you have 31 or 32% of the population are Jewish. So up until the rise to power of the Nazis, the Jewish population in Palestine was well under 20%. In fact, in 1917, when Balfour issues the declaration, it's 5% maybe of the whole. So you bring up an important point, which is this pretense that this is a land without a people for a people without a land. Well, actually, this is not a land without a people. And even Balfour himself recognizes this. He says in a memo that I quote in the book, we just don't consider these people's rights as important as the rights of the people to whom we're promising the homeland. They're not as important, in other words, as the Jewish people. So the Brits knew that the Arabs were there, this overwhelming majority. And early Zionists did. I mean, Ahad Haam was writing these letters from Palestine saying, you're pretending there's nobody here. There are people here. And they're not gonna put up with this. But people preferred to ignore that. And that was based up until the present, I would argue.
And I would agree. And I think just in terms of like the Balfour Declaration, we should, contextualize that briefly for us, because my understanding is that that declaration was both a function of, well, it was primarily a function of a British Empire outpost, essentially, in that region to hold off maybe France's power that was in Algiers, et cetera. Just walk us through that. And then,
right.
You know, there is some element of Balfour's anti-Semitism. It was sort of a twofer for him.
Right. I mean, there's several elements to the Balfour Declaration. The most important one is the one you mentioned, which is that Britain wanted Palestine for strategic reasons long before, you know, Chaim Weizmann sold the idea to the British cabinet during World War I. Back in 1906, 1907, they realized they needed to control Palestine, partly to keep other powers out, as you suggest, but mainly as a buffer for the defense of the eastern frontier of Egypt. And that was the strategic reason. And then they later on realized we need to control the Mediterranean terminus of the shortest route between the Mediterranean and the Gulf. And that's Haifa. That's Palestine. So for essentially strategic reasons, Britain wanted Palestine long before they agreed to issue the Balfour Declaration, long before this they saw the Zionist movement as a potential ally in this project. Now, there's other elements, of course. There's what you could call British philo-Semitism or Christian Zionism, which actually antedates Jewish Zionism. You have British aristocrats back in the 1830s, 40s, 50s saying, you know, it's a Christian duty to reestablish the Jewish people in the land of Israel. Very important British political figures are talking about this long before modern political Zionism. And then you have anti-Semitism. So Balfour himself, before he became foreign secretary, had been prime minister at a time of some of the most intense persecution of Jews in the Russian Empire. The Kishinev pogrom and many other pogroms were taking place in Russia after the 1905 revolution. And people were fleeing by the thousands, these horrible pogroms and this terrible persecution, and trying to come to England. And so Balfour's government actually passes something called the Alien Exclusion Act to keep persecuted Jews out of England, motivated essentially by anti-Semitism. And so you have the irony of a British politician who authored probably the most anti-Semitic act in English history since, you know, King Edward kicked all the Jews out of England in 1290, being the author of the Balfour Declaration, promising the Jewish people a homeland, promising to support a homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. It's one of many ironies in this story.
Right. And another irony to me is how Zionism took on so many of the characteristics of the very nationalism that led to the persecution of Jews in Europe, this European form of nationalism. Can you speak to how modern Zionism and political Zionism in the context of Israel takes that very shape of nationalism that, you know, ended up resulting in World War II, for example?
Right. Well, I think you have to look at the people who are the first proponents of Zionism. They're almost all Eastern European. That is to say, they're people who grew up either in the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the Habsburg Empire, people like Herzl himself, who came from Budapest and lived in Vienna, or came from what was then called the Pale of Settlement, an area that is now in Ukraine, around today's Kyiv. 34, I think, of the signatories of the Israeli Declaration of Independence come from within 200 miles. They originated from towns and villages and shtetls within 200 miles of Kyiv. So this is an Eastern European nationalist project. It grew up in conversation with Eastern European nationalism. You're absolutely right, Emma. And it has all the characteristics of Eastern European nationalism. A certain focus on ethnicity, blood and soil, and so on and so forth. And that's Zionism as a political ideology, is essentially one of several nationalisms that grows up in Eastern Europe among Eastern European Jews who are particularly persecuted and who see as their only refuge to escape European anti-Semitism and go elsewhere. It didn't always have to be Palestine. There were some who talked about East Africa. There were some who talked about Argentina, but the majority ended up deciding that it had to be. And there were some who talked about Sinai, but they ended up deciding it had to be Palestine, the land of Israel, partly for the biblical, because of the biblical connection, obviously.
And all right, so let's we're at the end of World War II, and there, what was the dynamic that led things like the Haganah and the Irgun and the Stern Gang? I mean, I don't know how much people are aware, like Menachem Begin, who will later play a very big role, I think, in where Israel is today, in terms of like specific, almost a unique one in terms of like the turning of you know, maybe analogous to Reagan, although I think in a more severe way during that era.
There's a good comparison there, yeah.
But he is responsible or leading, I think it was the Irgun at that time, for blowing up the King David Hotel, killing, I think it was 90-some-odd people. It was arguably partially a military target, although I guess the British would, you know, I mean, arguably, certainly there were a lot of non-military personnel were killed. Right. In this it was being blown up because they didn't want information that the British had found from what other Zionists were doing within Palestine to be known. But what explain that dynamic that's going on there? Were there terrorist groups? Stern Gang, I think, you know, unequivocally seems to me to be a terrorist group that were advocating. They were pushing Britain to like basically pull the trigger and provide the sort of like a Palestinian mandate. What was the dynamic there?
The dynamic there, I think you have to go back a little bit to understand that after, you know, wholeheartedly supporting Zionism right through the 20s and the 30s and crushing this massive Palestinian revolt from 1936 to 39, 14 to 17% of adult male Palestinians were killed, wounded, imprisoned, or exiled by the British, who brought in, as I said, 100,000 troops to crush this revolt. Having done that, they realized that they were on the brink of World War II, the British, and they had to fight World War II against Italy and Germany in the Middle East, in a situation where colonial peoples all over the world supported the Palestinians and loathed the British for what they had done to them. And so you had British officials in Egypt and in India saying, we have to change our policy. We cannot continue to support unlimited immigration and blanket support for the Zionists and suppression of the Palestinians, because we're going to have to fight in Egypt. We're going to have to fight in Iraq. We need the Indian army. They were not able to send Indian troops to Palestine to crush the revolt in the late 30s because they weren't sure of their loyalty. They were afraid they would side with the Palestinians. So Britain changes its policy. It shuts down immigration. It promises independence to what would have then been a majority Arab Palestine within 10 years. And which the shutting down of immigration, mind you, is coming at the height of the persecution of Jews in Europe. And Palestine, given racist immigration laws in the United States, the racist immigration laws in England, Palestine was the only place people could go to who were able to escape Europe. So the British shut that down, infuriating, obviously, the Zionists. And they turn against the British at that point. And that's where the Irgun and the Stern Gang start assassinating British officials, killing British soldiers, blowing up British trains, and ultimately blowing up, as you said, the King David Hotel, which was the British headquarters, but where many dozens of people, innocent people, were killed in addition to British officials. So that's what explains the shift of the Zionists against the British. The British said basically in 1939, we've done what we promised. We've created a Jewish national home. Now we've got to fight World War II, and we need the support of the Arabs, or at least we can't continue to alienate them. And so they make a shift in 1939 with what's called the White Paper of 1939. And the Zionist movement never forgives them. And so you have this intense war against Britain, especially after World War II ends, which is intended to force the British out of Palestine. In the meantime, the Zionist movement has found new patrons in Washington and in Moscow. And these are the powers that help to push through the partition resolution, which gives most of Palestine to a Jewish minority as a Jewish state.
And I just want to just go back one more. The revolt of 36, what precipitated that? And give us a sense of what kind of communities existed in Palestine at that time.
Right. Well, I mean, I think the casualty toll tells you the people were pretty committed to fighting the British, pretty committed to the idea that this is our country, we should control it. We were promised in the Covenant of League of Nations that we were a provisionally independent country, and we never got that. Instead, the British helped to establish a completely different national movement and gave it exclusive rights in Palestine. So the Palestinians were revolting against the British and against Zionism. And you had a pretty cohesive Palestinian national movement, divided with different political trends. But the casualty toll alone tells you how committed people were to fighting the British when you have that number of people killed, wounded, imprisoned. And I mean, my uncle was sent off to the Seychelles. He was exiled. The whole leadership was thrown in jail and often exiled places like the Seychelles and Kenya and so on. Others were just shot on sight or hanged, other leaders. So the British had crushed what was really a national revolt by the Palestinians against their rule and against the mandate, which essentially gave the British the right from the League of Nations to run Palestine for the benefit of the Zionist project. That's what the Palestinians were revolting against.
I think what's so important, too, about that moment in history is it really illustrates that this is a nationalist movement that is not a function of anti-Semitism. They had a problem with the British.
And they had a problem with the settlers. But the point is, if the settlers had been Danes or Martians, right, they would have opposed them.
Right.
I mean, the idea is somebody else is coming in here and getting national rights at our expense and planning to take over our country. If they'd been blue, green, white, red, Christian, Buddhist, whatever, they would have opposed them. And there would have been nothing anti-Christian in opposing a Danish settler project backed by the British.
Right. And I think that point has been obscured both, you know, deliberately and perhaps inadvertently but with a specific, as a way of making this some type of like timeless conflict that was exactly. not tied to
national religious war.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. It's not a religious war. It's become more religious over time. But it's essentially a conflict against what Palestinians perceive as a settler colonial project backed by external powers. And whoever the settlers were, I mean, in this case, they have a religious connection and there's a religious element to Zionism, of course. But that's not what is important to the Palestinians. What's important to the Palestinians, they came to create a Jewish state in an Arab-majority country and transform what Jabotinsky described in one of his articles, to transform Palestine into the land of Israel. And that's what Jabotinsky's successors, starting with Menachem Begin in 1977, have tried to do. So Begin, Shamir, Ariel Sharon, Netanyahu, they're all in the line of thought of Jabotinsky and his followers, arguing you have to take this country over by force. The native population will resist. This is a colonial project. All of these things are things that Jabotinsky says, and that people like Begin and Shamir, to their credit, believe. They don't pretend, as labor Zionists used to, oh no, we intend to help the local population. We never intended to harm them. Jabotinsky and his followers are much more blunt about this.
There are two elements that seem to converge when we get to Begin, and that era is you know 20 some odd years from where we are at this moment. But when Israel the mandate happens, the UN mandate happens, Israel gets about 80% of the land. And we should say in the lead up to this, there are basically, I don't know how else to describe it, ethnic cleansings, right, of, you know, both massacres like Deir Yassin. But there's bombing, there's ethnic cleansing that drives a lot of people into Gaza, for that matter, right, at that time, in addition to, to the West Bank. But talk about, you write about the Israeli military at that time has gotten its training from the British,
correct,
particularly in their counterinsurgency, because it seems like, you know, at one point that military doctrine and training meets up with the sort of the completely unabashed, I don't know what the best is to describe, sort of like that Begin era and forward, but almost a fascism, if you will, that those two things combined. But talk about that military training at that time,
right,
and how it is continued. We see it in play today.
Yeah, I mean, what happens is during this revolt, the British really lack manpower to put down the Palestinians. This is at a time of crises in Europe where the British need to keep their army alert just in case war erupts with Germany. This is the time of the Sudetenland crisis. This is the time of the Anschluss with Austria, where Hitler's taking over pieces of Central Europe, and the British are afraid they're about to get to a war. So they don't have any reserves. And so a British intelligence officer by the name of Ord Wingate says, let's take some of the guys from the Zionist militias, some of the best leaders in the Palmach and the Haganah. The Palmach is the strike force of the main militia of the Haganah. And let's train them together with British soldiers to launch offensive operations. And what he's basically doing is distilling generations of British counterinsurgency doctrine and teaching it to the people who go on to become generals in the Israeli army. So Moshe Dayan is one of his mentees. Yigal Alon, later a minister and chief of staff of the Israeli army, is one of his mentees. Yitzhak Sadeh, who's the chief of staff of the later on of the Haganah, is one of his mentees, as are dozens and dozens of others who become the elite of the Israeli army. They become the chiefs of staff. They become, in the case of Dayan, minister of defense later on. And these guys are taught all the brutality, shooting of prisoners, torture, blowing up houses over people's heads, that the British have been practicing in Ireland, in India, in other parts of the British Empire. So British counterinsurgency doctrine is taught to these guys as part of the effort of the British to quell this great revolt. And this is the doctrine which the Israeli army now acknowledges is at the core of their own doctrine. I mean, you read Alon's history of the Israeli army. You read Zeb Schiff's history of the Israeli army. They devote pages and pages to Ord Wingate and British training and British ideas. So, and that has informed the Israeli army long before Begin became prime minister in 1977. That's informed the Israeli army from the 50s onwards. So you have these massacres carried out of villages where infiltrators have entered and killed Israelis. They go in and they kill a whole lot of people. And that's the stuff that Ord Wingate and the British counterinsurgency officers trained them to do back in the 1930s when they were young officers. And that is the doctrine of the Israeli army to this day. That's what you see today in Gaza on a much, much, obviously, larger scale.
And so in 1948, following the UN mandate.
The UN partition.
I guess it could also be referenced as the Nakba. The war begins with Arab countries.
Right.
This is probably the time that Israel develops its David and Goliath sort of, I guess, image in the world.
Right.
And that sustains it. And about another 250,000 Palestinians are dispossessed in that war, having already hundreds of thousands, more than half a million, I think, prior to that, had been
actually about 300,000 are kicked out, expelled, ethnically cleansed, if you will, in the fighting before the Arab armies enter, and about another 500,000 or 400,000 are expelled after four Arab armies enter the war on May 15th, 1948. So in March and April and May of 48, before the mandate ends, before the British leave, before the State of Israel is created, before the Arab armies enter, Jaffa, 70,000 people, Haifa, 70,000 people, Bisan, Safa, Tiberias, all fall, and their populations are kicked out. And West Jerusalem, 30,000 people are kicked out. So you have hundreds of thousands of people driven from their homes before the Arab armies enter, and then another four or 500,000 after the Arab armies enters. And so you have four Arab armies that enter, the Egyptian, the Syrian, the Iraqi, and the Jordanian. And that's the Arab-Israeli war that we think of. But what people forget is that long before this, there was a war going on. From the moment the partition resolution is adopted, the Palestinians refuse it. They reject it. They say, this is our country. We're the majority. We're entitled to self-determination under the UN Charter. Why are we not being given it? Why is most of our country being turned into a Jewish state? 58% was to 55% was to be given to the Jewish state. And by the end of the war, as you said, almost 80% has been conquered by Israel, with the people, most of the population, ethnically cleansed.
And so how would you characterize those next 20 years until the 67 war?
Well, a lot of things are happening that people don't pay much attention to. Most of the land in what becomes the State of Israel is Arab-owned. Jewish ownership was about 6% in 1948. And what happens is everybody who's left has their land confiscated. It's put under a custodian of absentee property, and it's handed over to Jewish settlements, Jewish communities, or kept by the state, Israel Lands Authority. Most of the land, about half of the land of Palestinians who stayed behind in Israel and become citizens of the State of Israel, is taken from them. confiscated in different ways. And their communities are restricted to very tiny spaces. They're never allowed to build outside of very restrictive municipal boundaries. So I have a city like Nazareth, which is surrounded with Jewish settlements such that it can't expand. Or you have other communities inside Israel of Palestinians. That's happening without anybody paying attention. Palestinians inside Israel, citizens of the state of Israel, are under martial law from 1948 until 1966. They have to get a permit from the military governor, in most cases, to even go from city to city. They're under surveillance by the Shabakh, by the General Security Services. They live under martial law, even though they're supposedly citizens and they have the right to vote. Meanwhile, the 750,000 people who are expelled live as refugees, whether in the Gaza Strip, where all of the Palestinians from southern, what becomes southern Israel, are confined under Egyptian military administration, or in the Gaza, or in the West Bank, or in Jordan, or in Syria, or in Lebanon.
And the 67 war is again ostensibly a defensive war by Israel at this point, and they successfully essentially take at that time the Sinai and right. And the West Bank and
the Golan Heights
from Syria. Where was the United States in terms of where did that Israeli military might come from, and was it how preordained was that victory based upon their strength?
Well, I in the book, I quote, General Wheeler, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, and the President Johnson at the time, talking to the Israeli envoy who was sent to Washington to get a green light for this war. And he says, you're going to whip them anyway. If they attack you first, you'll beat them. And if you launch a preemptive strike, you'll just crush them. So the estimation of American military intelligence and the CIA was that Israel was vastly superior to all the Arab armies put together, even if the Arabs had attacked, as the Israelis were saying they might do. We now know that they probably couldn't and wouldn't attack, but the Israelis thought they might. But they intended to preempt. And what they went to Washington, what they sent an envoy to Washington to get was a green light for an Israeli preemptive war and for American support in the wake of that. Now, the military might that Israel had in 1967 was essentially based on French and British weapons. Americans' weapon shipments had only just begun. Israel was just getting anti-aircraft missiles, Hawk anti-aircraft missiles, and some Skyhawk bombers came a little later. But essentially, they fought the war with Mirages and with French and British tanks and artillery. Only after 67 do American weapons become the core element in Israel's military might. F-4 Phantoms starting in 1968. Top of the line, the best fighter bomber in the world starts to be supplied only in 1968. So they fight the war with French and British equipment, but with American diplomatic support.
And what happens to the Palestinian population there? Are more dispossessed, or is it just simply more who become occupied?
Well, the ones who are in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip and at Sinai and the Golan Heights for the Egyptians and Syrians who live there, they come under military occupation. But in the meantime, Israel expels about 300,000 more people from villages to the west of Jerusalem, from refugee camps in the Jordan River Valley, and many others who are outside or kept outside. So another 250,000. Are expelled in the wake, Palestinians are expelled in the wake of the 67 war.
Can you now track for us to sort of like what's happening with Palestinian nationalism? Because you write that this is around the beginning of an era where Palestinian nationalism has its most success politically.
Right.
There is certainly moments of, I guess, you could call terrorism and in some instances but primarily the gains are happening in terms of politics.
Right.
Can you walk us through that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, what happens after 1948 is a complete devastation of the Palestinian national movement. It's already crushed by the British in the late 30s. The sort of coup de grace comes with the Nakba. The elites in the coastal cities are driven into exile. Everybody loses everything. Everybody who's expelled loses everything. Many of the people who stay behind lose everything. And it takes a long time for the Palestinian National Movement to rebuild itself. And this happens in the 50s and 60s. And by the 1960s, you have a Palestine Liberation Organization, which is taken over by these commando organizations, which preach armed struggle against Israel, which call for the liberation of Palestine, and which, you know, ignite the imagination, not just of Palestinians, but of people all over the Arab world in the wake of the defeat of these Arab armies, the Egyptian, the Syrian, and the Jordanian in the 67 war. But their major victories, exactly as you say, are actually diplomatic and political. They gain the support of over 100 countries the world over, who end up having, you know, Palestinian embassies in their capitals. They, for the first time, the Palestinians address the world. Palestinian representatives come to the UN, Arafat and others come to the UN and speak on behalf of the Palestine cause. And that's something that the British prevented back in the day. That's something that doesn't happen in 1947. Partition is decided over the heads of the Palestinians. They're never consulted about the partition of their own country. So what happens in the 70s and 80s is a resurgence of the Palestinian cause, but mainly, as you say, on the political and diplomatic level. Their military achievements are nil or very, very limited.
What accounts for that? I mean, is this simply because we have like in some ways a global liberation movement? Is it because the U.S. is because there is because of the Cold War, there is this sort of sense of like we need to recognize indigenous people. I mean, this is an era where in this country, certainly there was a more recognition of our responsibility to indigenous people and to the sort of wholesale slaughter. And, you know, there's a whole lot of like sort of intellectual movements happening at this time. In the 80s, there was a lot of there were a series of new historians who got access to Israeli documents that showed what I mean. Is that part of what had happened in that era?
Yeah, I think it really starts with the era of decolonization, and the Palestinians ride that wave. In other words, they argue you all have gotten freed from colonialism, you all have established your independent states. People in Africa, people in Asia, are liberated from European colonialism in the wake of World War II. And the Palestinians get a lot of support globally on the basis of that argument. We never got our independence. We were colonized, the British, the Zionists, and we you know, are like you, a people that desires self-determination. And that's where you get the support in the United Nations to this day for elements of the Palestinian narrative. I think you're also right that in this country, there's the beginnings in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, but very limited stirrings of support for the Palestinians. I don't think that the main narrative changes. The main narrative is essentially established by Israel and its supporters in the United States, link the establishment of Israel to the persecution of Jews in Europe, link the establishment of Israel to, you know, an ancestral link to the Holy Land, link the establishment of Israel, most importantly, to the Holocaust, and to Western guilt about the fact that not more was done to save people from the Holocaust, Jews who could have been saved from the Holocaust. Had the United States opened the gates of immigration before World War II, huge numbers of people could have been saved, or had other countries done so. So there's a lot of guilt for good reasons. They should have been guilty. They were guilty. And that, I think, helped to fuel a narrative where the Palestinians are simply removed from the picture. Nobody sees them. And that begins to change, as you say, probably in the 80s, partly as a result of revelations from the Israeli archives that most of what Israelis have argued about what happened in 1948 was false. Palestinians didn't leave because their leaders told them to. They left at the point of a bayonet or because they were terrified and because their cities were being bombarded with David Kam orders or there were, you know, attacks on their, you know, convoys and supply routes and so on and so forth. So that those realities begin to intrude into the narrative. But I think we still have a long way to go to get rid of some of the most pernicious myths about this war.
Without a doubt. In fact, that's partly a large reason why we wanted to speak with you. I'm I'm also fascinated by the history. So as we move forward and the PLO is in exile, or at least the leadership is, this chapter with Iqbal Ahmed, who I had never been familiar with, a Pakistani intellectual who was also a revolutionary and involved in other revolutionary movements around the globe, meets in Lebanon. When was that in terms of the timing and and what did he tell us about his role here?
Right. Well, Iqbal Ahmed was, as you say, a Pakistani intellectual. He had worked with Frantz Fanon briefly as part of the FLN, Front de Libération Nationale, the Algerian National Movement against French colonialism. And he ended up teaching here in the United States at, I think, Hampshire College. He wrote a number of influential works. But he was always, you know, in touch with liberation movements and with, you know, progressive thought. And he was asked to come to Lebanon by the PLO to assess their military, to assess their strategy. And as I mentioned in the book, he came back and he said, "You guys are going about it all wrong. You know, I have nothing against violence." I mean, he'd worked with the FLN in Algeria. They liberated Algeria through enormous violence, much of it directed against civilians, by the way, against French settlers, civilians. He said, "But against this enemy, you're going about it the wrong way. This will not work. Violence against Israelis actually cements the strength of Israeli society." So he gave them his assessment. They didn't like it, and he went back to the United States. And I quote this in the book as something that I think people should be thinking about. You know, I think that what we've seen after October 7th, the triggering of trauma that has nothing to do with Palestine or Israel or the specific, you know, war we're talking about, but pre-existing trauma, going right back to the Holocaust. I mean, I've heard discussions of Kishinev, I've heard discussions of pogroms, I've heard, of course, discussions of the Holocaust, cited by people as what October 7th did force them to think about. And I think Iqbal Ahmed was gesturing to the same kind of problem. In this assessment that he wrote for the PLO.
When was that exactly?
That would have been, I think, 1979 or 80. I can't remember the date. I think it's in the book. Before 1982, before the PLO had to leave Lebanon.
Can you expand a little bit on that notion? Because we played this on the program before. Netanyahu came under fire a few years ago for spreading a conspiracy theory that the Palestinian Grand Mufti was actually responsible for planting the idea of exterminating the Jews in Hitler's head, and that Hitler did not want to do that. That was actually the Palestinians. Now, I mean, this is an extreme example. I mean, it's not even that extreme because he's the leader, at least within the context of Israeli society, because he's the leader of the country. But, like, this is kind of that progression of what you're talking about, of the linking of Palestinian nationalism and their efforts to fight back against colonialism with the trauma of the Holocaust, in a false way.
Right, right. Well, I mean, this has been a big effort of Zionist propaganda ever since World War II to link Palestinian nationalism, and in particular the Mufti, to the Nazis. And of course, the Mufti was linked to the Nazis. He took refuge in Berlin. He fled Palestine when the British arrested all of his colleagues in 1937. He was in Beirut for a long period of time. And then he had to flee Beirut when the French were going to hand him over to the British, and he went to Iraq. He had to flee Iraq when the British reinvaded Iraq. He went to Tehran. The Iranians wouldn't let him stay. He went to Turkey. The Turks wouldn't let him stay. So he ends up in Italy, and he then goes to Germany. And he spends the war supporting the Nazi war effort. What nobody talks about is that most other Palestinian leaders supported the British. The Mufti was in Germany. The other guys were supporting the British war effort. And thousands of Palestinians and hundreds of thousands of Arabs fought in the Allied armies. The divisions that liberated Marseille from the Nazis in 1944 were a Moroccan and an Algerian division with French officers. And there were thousands of Palestinians who fought, or Jordanians or others, who fought in the Allied ranks. So yes, the Mufti went to Germany. But there's nothing Nazi or anti-Semitic about Palestinian nationalism, even if the Mufti himself allied himself with the Nazis. By the way, he disappears from Palestinian politics immediately after World War II. He's completely discredited after World War II. So, but he is a iconic figure for Israeli propaganda simply because he did in fact go to Germany and he did in fact align himself with the Nazis. Netanyahu's claim is absolutely preposterous. You only have to read Mein Kampf, which was written long before the Mufti ever arrived in Germany, to understand Hitler's absolute hatred of the Jews and his desire to eliminate them from Germany. That did not come from the Mufti or the Arabs. It came from, you know, deep-rooted German anti-Semitism.
I should also say there were members of the Stern Gang who made a similar trek in the early 40s to recruit to attempt to throw off British rule and mandate. I should say in
Palestine. The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Right.
I mean, the Mufti's, you know, horrible strategic mistake and moral mistake was one that, as you say, was matched by others who were trying to get rid of the British, the Stern Gang in particular.
Let's talk about this. The invasion of Lebanon and the Begin era seemed to me to be a big turning point. Now I know you were in Lebanon at that time as a young man. I mean, for me personally, it was also, I was, I think, 15 years old, and I happened to be in Israel at the time on my, you know, confirmation trip, and we were in Caesarea watching the attack helicopters head up to Lebanon.
You did your bar mitzvah in 82?
My bar mitzvah was in 1980, and 2 years later, our confirmation class in Hebrew school did the 2 month summer in Israel, and that was for me like I think the beginning of the end of my understanding of Israel at that time. I became very alienated from my rabbi for the rest of that trip because it was the first time, at least from the perspective of my perspective at the time, and I think maybe history bears this out, where it was a completely offensive. There was no even sort of like a predicate, a threatening predicate per se. It did not seem to be defensive in any way, and it was. But explain to us that in the context of the Palestinian war on Palestine.
Right. Well, it was what Israelis called a war of choice. You know, Begin and Sharon, his defense minister, decided that the best way to eradicate Palestinian nationalism and ensure the absorption of the occupied territories, which was their objective, that was always the Likud party's objective. They'd just come to power in 77. So we're talking 5 years after Begin becomes prime minister. The best way to achieve this was to destroy the PLO in Beirut. And so Sharon comes to Washington, sells a bill of goods to the Secretary of State, Haig, telling him we'll eliminate Syrian presence from Lebanon, we'll put a puppet government in, and we will get rid of the PLO. And the United States gives him a green light, similar to the green light in 1967. And as you say, this is a war of choice. There was nothing going on. There was a ceasefire that had been arranged for more than a year. So there were no rockets landing in Galilee. There was no shelling. There was no pretext. A dissident anti-PLO group had just assassinated tried to assassinate the Israeli ambassador in London, and that was the pretext for this. But it had nothing to do with it. The plan had been approved in May by Haig. You know, Sharon goes to Washington, shows him what he's going to do. This was just a pretext, the attempted assassination of Argov. The invasion succeeds in one respect, in that the PLO is forced out. But Syrian influence is not reduced. In fact, the Syrians continue their occupation of part of Lebanon even after the invasion. The puppet government that the Israelis installed fails to establish a peace treaty with Israel. And you have, in exchange for the expulsion, after the expulsion of the PLO, the rise of a much more lethal opponent of Israel, which is the rise of Hezbollah, which is created as a result of the 1982 war. Didn't exist before this. Barak, Ehud Barak, who later becomes Israeli prime minister, he was chief of staff. He says Hezbollah didn't exist before our invasion. Our invasion created it. So it was one of the more disastrous decisions in Israeli history.
And then, two, shortly after that, Israel, in an attempt to disempower Fatah to the extent that it remains, is to sort of squeeze Fatah as a political movement, but also it seems to have sort of like given wide berth to the sort of within a couple of years minted Hamas out right. of the Muslim Brotherhood.
Right.
And as a way of like preventing any type of Palestinian political cohesiveness at that point.
I mean, you have to understand Israel as having learned the lessons of colonialism from the British. The core, I mean, since Julius Caesar, the core doctrine of an imperial power has to be divide and rule your subjects. You have to split them up. You have to turn them against one another to prevent them from uniting against you. And this was the doctrine of Israeli military intelligence, especially in the Gaza Strip, against the PLO, which was the representative of the Palestinians recognized internationally and by the Arab League and by the Palestinians. You create an alternative, and their chosen alternative was what was then called the Islamic Mujamma al-Islami, Islamic Assemblance or whatever that is. Anyway, the branch of the Muslim Brotherhood in Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood in the Gaza Strip, and so they supported them. I know people who were beaten up in the West Bank by thugs bussed in by Israel from the Gaza Strip to break up PLO demonstrations at universities in the West Bank. These are guys that the Israelis are essentially using against the PLO, and it's out of that trend that ultimately Hamas grows. And at the very beginning of Hamas, we're talking 87, 88, the Israelis look favorably on this because this divides the Palestinian national movement. These guys are hardliners. The PLO is trying to turn more diplomatic. It undermines their standing as diplomats and as representatives of the Palestinians if there's a hardline alternative that we can point at and say these guys are terrorists, there's nobody to talk to. And that's the strategy essentially later on of Netanyahu. Allow Qatar to send money to the Gaza Strip to support this Hamas separatist Hamas government, separate from the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah. And that gives you a great argument. There's nobody to talk to. We can't negotiate. Therefore, we'll just keep colonizing the West Bank and absorbing it and annexing it. So that emerges from a strategy that goes right back to the 70s and the 80s, actually.
And it is around this time that we have the First Intifada, which is largely, obviously there's some violence, but largely a peaceful a protest movement that I guess, I mean, and you would know, you participated in the 91 Madrid talks, but it started to perhaps move in a direction of perhaps a two-state solution, which, I mean, just, I guess, talk about the Palestinian understanding of, at one point, a two-state solution is going to be, it's not right. what we want, we're not, but they were ceding the territory, essentially, that they had lost from 48 to 68, and we're in a different phase here.
All right. Well, this starts back in the 1970s, after the 73 war, when the PLO realizes that nobody's going to help them liberate all of Palestine. And slowly but surely, they move towards acceptance of a two-state solution. They move towards acceptance of Security Council Resolution 242. They move towards an acceptance of renunciation of violence. And they do that finally in 1988 at the Palestine National Council. And that eventually is recognized by the United States as meeting American conditions for talking to the PLO. And ultimately, that's the basis for the Madrid and later the Washington negotiations, that the PLO has accepted a renunciation of violence. It's accepted the American imposed ground rules for the negotiations. It's accepted to recognize the state of Israel. It does all of these things. It changes its charter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you are in a new phase. And the reason this works, I would argue, does go back to the Intifada. The First Intifada, which is, grassroots, popular uprising against occupation, which includes some violence, but very little explosives, very little weapons, you know, rocks against soldiers. There is violence, but compared to what comes later, very, very little. But it shows the Israelis. It shows the Israeli leadership. It shows Rabin, who later becomes prime minister, that you cannot maintain the occupation as it was. And it eventually brings the Israelis to the table to do what they'd never accepted to do before, which is to negotiate with the PLO.
And that leads to the Oslo. Will you characterize the Oslo Accords for us? Because there is a... I think that it's incredibly misunderstood as to like what happened there and where it left things.
Right. What Baker and George H.W. Bush did was to create at Madrid and afterwards a setup where the Arab countries could negotiate peace with Israel. Jordan did. Syria almost did. They came very, very close to an agreement with Israel. But the Palestinians were not allowed to negotiate a peace treaty and independence and a two-state solution with Israel. They were told, you can only negotiate for self-rule, for autonomy, for an interim period, after which you will be allowed to discuss final status issues. Final status issues included everything important to the Palestinians: independence, self-determination, delineation of borders, refugees, Jerusalem, water, end of settlement, end of occupation. You couldn't talk about any of those things. All we were allowed to discuss in 10 rounds of negotiations in 91, 92, and 93 was the details of self-rule under continued Israeli occupation and with continued expansion of settlements. When we tried to say, how can we one party be eating the pizza that we're supposed to be dividing, the Americans didn't say anything. They said the ground rules didn't allow that, but they didn't do anything about Israel doing that. So the people negotiating in Washington, who were authorized by the PLO, I was an advisor to that delegation, ended up by the summer of 1993 saying, we're not going to get independence out of this. This is a structure designed to prevent us from having self-determination and to postpone everything with no guarantees that we'll get it. Arafat and the PLO decided to accept that deal anyway. And that's what the Oslo Accords are. The Oslo Accords were an interim agreement. They were not a peace treaty, whereby the PLO recognized Israel. Israel did not recognize Israel recognized the PLO. It didn't recognize Palestinians had a right to self-determination and independence or a Palestinian state. So it wasn't a reciprocal, equal agreement. It was an agreement by one side to recognize the legitimacy of the other side and by that side to talk to the other side, but not to concede anything. And actually, Rabin, in his last speech in the Knesset, says, what we're offering the Palestinians is less than a state. And we will continue to control the Jordan River Valley. And therefore, we will continue to have security control indefinitely into the indefinite future. So that was his vision. And he was the one who went the farthest of any Israeli leader up to that point.
How much was that dynamic a function of George Herbert Walker Bush being more skeptical towards Israel than probably... Well, certainly the president since then,
and
probably before,
yeah.
Versus Clinton, and then it sort of became like a race. It seemed to be who was going to be less of a honest broker in these negotiations in terms of various administrations.
I mean, it wasn't just Bush Senior; it was also his Secretary of State.
Baker was sort of famously said, we don't have to worry about the Jews. They're not going to vote for us. I mean, he was he was very much a realist, I guess.
Oh, absolutely. I think both of them felt that in the wake of the Gulf War, this great American victory, and in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War, they talked about a new world order. They wanted to settle this conflict, and they went very far towards settling it. In other words, they got the Jordanians and the Israelis eventually to a peace treaty in 94. The Syrians and the Israelis were this close to a deal. Baker left the State Department in order to run Bush's failed reelection campaign. And at that point, the thing collapsed. Whether Baker would have been able and Bush would have been able to do more than they ended up doing or that Clinton did is another question. But we felt that the thing sort of collapsed at that point. We negotiating in Washington, These negotiations took place in the basement of the State Department. We sensed that once Baker left the building, the cat was gone and the mice would play. And so people like Aaron David Miller later on said, we ended up operating as lawyers for Israel. We weren't honest brokers. And he was one of the people we were dealing with on the American side. Him and Dennis Ross and Martin Indyk and folks. Indyk then comes in with the Clinton administration. They were more concerned about Israeli domestic politics and American-Israeli relations than they were about the Palestinians or a sustainable deal, in my opinion. And the thing really never had a chance. I would argue from that point, certainly from that point on.
Can we jump to, because I don't want to hold you much longer. You've been very
patient. I actually have to get going. So,
oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Let's wrap it up soon.
Lastly, Gaza, George W. Bush administration, seems to press on the gas, whereas prior administrations had been a little bit, practiced some restraint on the Israeli government. What happens at that time?
Well, one thing that happens is that Palestinians in the 90s, after the Oslo Accords, realize that the Oslo Accords are not going to bring them independence or self-determination. Settlement expands enormously. The number of settlers doubles. The restrictions on Palestinian movement are imposed such that free movement ends. People could go anywhere from the West Bank in the Gaza Strip. You could go to Eilat. You could go to the Golan Heights with Palestinian license plates before Oslo. After Oslo, walls, checkpoints, the enclosure of Palestinians in these tiny little ghettos of Area A, Area B, and Israel controlling 60% of the West Bank and Area C, shows the Palestinians that this is not a peace process. This is a process for the maintenance and extension of the status quo of occupation and colonization. And so you have a second intifada starting in 2000. And Bush's reaction to that, on top of 9/11, is to treat the Palestinians as if they're analogous to Al-Qaeda. Terrorists are terrorists. He basically buys the bill of goods that Sharon sells him, of a war on terror. He and Cheney and his their henchmen buy Sharon's prescription. And the United States basically becomes an even more overt enemy of the Palestinians from that point on. And I would argue that that's a thread that goes right back to Truman. A degree of hostility to the Palestinians, a degree of uncaringness about Palestinian rights, a degree of solicitude for every possible Israeli position, to the point that the United States is actually an ally of Israel in its war on the Palestinians. And we see this today in Gaza. This is not an Israeli war. This is an Israeli-American war. It couldn't happen without the Security Council vetoes. It couldn't happen without the resupply on a daily basis by plane after plane after plane of ammunition. It couldn't happen without the United States basically repeating every Israeli talking point. Israeli security is sacred. Israel has a right to defend itself. Hamas must be destroyed. And the things that follow from that are ethnic cleansing, are genocide, are the starvation of an entire people, entirely as a result of the actions of Israel, which is backed to the hilt by the United States. People are not starving because there's a natural disaster. They're starving because water and food and medicine and supplies are prevented from entering on an unlimited basis into Gaza by Israel. Israel is starving Gaza, and the United States is supporting that. So on the one hand, it is supporting this starvation and this deprivation of medical treatment and water and so forth. And at the same time, it's dropping 38,000 meals a day from aircraft. I mean, it's an insult to, on the one hand, actually enable Israel's starvation of these people, and then to pretend that you're doing something about it. You do something about it by forcing the Israelis to open up every crossing point, forcing them, telling them on pain of XYZ, you will do this. But there's no on pain of anything. So it is an American war, not just an Israeli war. And I don't think that differs except in extent from earlier phases of this war. You go back and look at 67, Johnson gives them a green light. You go back and look at 82, Haig gives them a green light. This is more than a green light, of course.
This is building the roads in some respect.
Exactly.
Lastly, last question. The other Arab countries that we have seen in the past, Where are they in this? I mean, the U.S. is the U.S. like quelching that simultaneously? What I've been sort of a little bit shocked by.
It's perplexing unless you recognize the fact that these are governments that don't represent their peoples. If you study a little bit of the history of this, you'll see that Arabs have been supportive of the Palestinians since before World War I. I found hundreds of articles on Zionism in Palestine in the press in 1912, 13, 14. You had volunteers coming to fight in Palestine with the Palestinians in the 1930s. And you had that again in 1948. And the polling in Arab countries is unanimous. Overwhelming majorities of Arabs in every single Arab country support the Palestinians. Their governments do not represent them. They are jackboot military dictatorships. They are the most absolute monarchies on earth. They have no representative democratic nature whatsoever. There are a few exceptions, of course, but the majority of them, Algeria, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Egypt. I mean, you talk about the major Arab countries. They're dictatorships or absolute monarchies. So they don't represent their people, and they lack legitimacy, and they therefore depend on whom? The United States. Mm. So they are more responsive to the United States and Israel than they are to their own public opinion. So they don't have political parties, free political parties. They don't have a free press. They don't allow demonstrations. They put people in jail for saying anything. I mean, how do you expect people to? So you've had demonstrations all over the Arab world against the will of the governments, but they haven't forced the governments to do what the people want, which is to support the Palestinians much more vigorously. The only people who have actually done anything are the Houthis, the Ansar Allah, folks who dominate most of Yemen, and a few other small groups, and Hezbollah, which is not a small group.
Well, I really appreciate your taking this time. I know we kept you longer than we should have, but this context, I think, is so important for people to understand where we are today. Rashid Khalidi, the professor of modern Arab studies at Columbia University, the book, The 100 Years War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, put a link to at majority.fm. Again, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate
thank you.
It.
Thanks so much.
Jordan Peterson, Elon Musk.
Sure. This is an old one, right?
Yeah, it's about a couple weeks old.
But this is worth doing.
Because Elon is like not the weirdest guy in an interview.
Yeah, Elon Musk went on with Jordan Peterson to make himself look in some way mainstream. We should say Elon Musk is being investigated by the state of Michigan. He dumped $45 million a month into a PAC. First, he said he was going to support Trump. Then he pretended like he wasn't, but he's still dumping this money into this PAC that essentially tries to target. And there's some question as to like who he's trying to target on social media. He also owns one of these platforms, so he's probably like paying himself off to like drive his ad rates on Twitter. But he's trying to pinpoint certain voters, and there's some question as to whether he's providing this information. It's supposedly like to register voters, but all he's doing is putting them into a data bank to assess whether they are supportive of Trump. And if they are, then go and register them and get them out to vote. Now, that's illegal. If you're an organization that registers voters, you need to be nonpartisan. Not just in your rhetoric. In fact, your rhetoric is the minimum. What you can't do is say, oh, we took all these registration forms. We're throwing out the ones that people don't vote for Trump. That's illegal. People go to prison for that.
It's not free speech.
It is not free speech. But before he got some acclaim for that, here he is with Jordan Peterson as they discuss the benefits of a strictly meat diet.
It's a hard sell from Jordan here.
Price.
Carnivore diet will fix that.
The what, sorry?
The carnivore diet will fix
that. Look, I'm all for, I like meat. I'm pro meat. I don't think a carnivore diet is going to fix this particular issue. I think
my wife had an injury of 40 years, okay. And it resolved in 2 years on the carnivore diet.
Wait, what is he saying before him? What is the problem that he's supposed to be dealing with here?
Right.
Yes.
That is just a ridiculously false statement.
So one of the things I've tried to do is to understand. So, like, there are a limited number of things that are undeniably real, and pain is one of them.
Yes.
Okay.
Like, so my back hurts a little.
Yes. So that's because you were up till 5 a.m.
No, I just have some injuries, whatever.
From wrestling?
I think some childhood injuries that, so although the final thing that caused some back and shoulder injuries was me foolishly fighting the world champion sumo wrestler and charging at him at full speed to knock him over, which I did succeed in doing, but
you paid a price for it.
A very, very high price.
Carnivore diet will fix that.
The what, sorry?
The carnivore diet will fix that.
I'm awful. I like
pause
meat.
For a second. First of all, meat. Like, just, this is one of the creepiest interviews. This is...
They should have, like, maybe it outlined a little bit.
It's just a weird... Like, there's, like, a weird... like, almost, like, weird... I don't want to say sexual tension, but, like... there's almost, like, just a weird, like, sort of, like... weird man crush tension that Peterson had. Like, Peterson seems so desperate to impress Musk. And Musk, of course, is desperate to just seem normal. And Peterson's so weird that there's a weirdness to this that is, go ahead.
Paid a price for it.
A very, very high price.
Carnivore diet will fix that.
The what, sorry?
The carnivore diet will fix that.
I like meat. I'm pro meat. I don't think a carnivore diet is going to fix this particular issue. I think
my wife had an injury of 40 years, and it resolved in 2 years on the carnivore diet.
Yeah, pause it.
You
pause
it. Steak or
this guy puts himself out there as a doctor, as a scientist. He complains about junk science all the time.
He's a big Fauci critic.
My wife had a physical ailment for 40 years. You have a back problem? My wife had a physical ailment for 40 years, ate meat for 2 years, and it was resolved. Like, I mean, just the idea, there's so much that's so magical thinking based. And I will just say this, I don't want to give away the secret too much, but the meat that she ate started with the letter S. So any meat you eat with the letter S at the beginning fixes your various physical ailments, because my wife had one. Now she doesn't. So what do you think about that?
Me foolishly fighting the world champion sumo wrestler
and
charging
at him at full speed to knock him over, which I did succeed in doing, but
you paid a price for it.
A very, very high price.
Carnivore diet will fix that.
The what, sorry?
The carnivore diet will fix that.
I like meat. I'm pro meat. I don't think a carnivore diet is going to fix this particular issue. I think
my wife had an injury of 40 years and it resolved in 2 years on the carnivore diet.
If you just eat steak or something?
Yeah.
I mean,
all beef.
All beef.
Sure.
Yes, anything that starts with a B.
I'm a pro. I like meat. But I think this is a... I think I'll probably need an operation or something. But anyway.
I'd try the carnivore diet.
Sure.
Anyways, that did happen to her. Okay. She couldn't lift her left arm above here. It took 40 years, and in 2 years it resolved.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was something to see.
Pause for a second. Like, honestly, like... like, never mind a guy who considers himself a doctor. If I'm sitting at a bar and it's 2 a.m. and I'm wasted talking to a guy who's also wasted, and this guy says this to me, I'm going to go like, I don't know, dude. I don't, maybe it could have been other things.
At this time,
No.
I've been clear. I'm not interested.
I want to make it absolutely clear. First off, everybody knows. Can't lift your arm above here, same as a back problem.
Clearly not enough burgers.
And if my wife ate only beef for 2 years and it resolved itself, clearly that's why. So, I'm a doctor.
I like meat, but I think this is a, I think I'll probably need an operation or something, but anyway.
I tried the carnivore diet.
Sure.
Anyways, that did happen to her. Okay. She couldn't lift her left arm above here.
Yeah.
It took 40 years, and in 2 years it resolved.
Okay.
Yeah, so that was something to see. It also rejuvenated her physically in a variety of different ways that were quite miraculous to watch.
Yeah, yeah.
And that hasn't stopped. So that's a weird thing, and I would have never believed it if I hadn't seen this, because it's so preposterous.
Sure.
Anyways, okay. I'm not going to proselytize about the carnivore diets.
Yeah.
So, I'm not going to proselytize.
I'm going to proselytize.
Proselytize.
The guy's worse than I am with pronouncing things. Yeah, no, it was crazy. This is, he thinks he's being rational because he says, I never expected it. I was completely blown away. I started to do this and this one crazy thing happened, and read, click through and watch my video and you'll find out what it was. And it was an all beef diet.
Yeah.
That saved my wife. A lot of other things happened too.
That guy could very easily be like a billion maze for like a all meat diet style, like QVC.
That's what I'm saying. It's complete funnel marketing.
2 a.m.
I, for one, never believed it was possible. But then this one thing happened that changed my life. Click through, watch the video until the end.
The Meef Riddler.
Use coupon code BEEF. Get 20% off.
I think I'll probably need to operation on this, but anyway.
No, rejuvenation has not stopped.
Miraculous,
it used to be
ways.
It was miraculous. She could only raise her arm to here, and now she can literally move her arm all the way 360. She has absolutely no cartilage in her shoulder anymore and can use her arm like a total windmill. In fact, I have glued her to the ceiling and she can function as a ceiling fan. That's how miraculous it's been. She literally, she has no ability to stop her arms from raising over her head and going around in a windmill.
We can thank God that Elon was uninterested enough to ask the follow-up, what sort of miraculous rejuvenations? Could you be more specific about that?
Well, she has the ability also to, her legs also. Had you ever seen the Flintstones when their legs move like wheels? This is what her legs do now because of the meat, 100% beef diet.
Sirloin. The what, sorry? The carnivore diet will fix that. The what, sorry? That's my favorite.
It's true. I know. I didn't believe it at the time either.
Normal guys.
Normal. So normal. Hey, folks, don't forget to hit the subscribe button and check out our daily show. We do it every day at 12 p.m. Eastern for about 2.5 hours. We even take phone calls. You should check that out.